Dr. Lloyd, I thought we'd start this afternoon talking about your military career and your work in the State Adjutant General's office. And I thought we'd start at the beginning, if that's okay with you. As I understand from one of our previous conversations, you rose from private to general in the military.
That's correct. I think somebody's door.
Excuse me.
Okay.
I really had not planned to have a military career necessarily. So I had a number of older people in my community. I was too young at the time of World War II to be in the Army or Navy. But in fact, I was only, I remember when as a child, I had been born in 1908, and when World War II started, I heard somebody talking about the war had been going on in Europe for a full year. I couldn't figure out how on earth people could fight for a full year, because I was used to seeing boys fighting. I just couldn't see how it would last for a year. But I can remember the armistice night very clearly when they really shot up the little town that I lived in West Kentucky, because everybody was so excited about the war that been over. And my father took me by the hand, took me uptown. We lived near the center of town, and everybody's up there, men firing pistols and shotguns and stuff, and they really riddled all the telephone lines. You couldn't get anybody on the phone that day, which makes me remember much better. But when the boys came back from Europe, we had one neighbor who was a captain over there, Captain Donan. Much older than I was, but he lived a few doors from us in Houston. I had one cousin who was in the Army during that war, and they used to tell me about it, and I listened. And naturally, when I went off to college at Western Kentucky, what is now Western Kentucky University, I found they had an ROTC unit, so nothing to do except I had to join that. Mm-hmm. And I was very proud to be in uniform, and drilled efficiently. They worked up really from a private to a cadet first lieutenant in the first 2 years.
In ROTC?
In ROTC. Mm-hmm. Uniform, we received no money in those days for being in ROTC, but I found that having a uniform to wear, a wool uniform at that, was very helpful on your budget.
Mm-hmm.
But I finished Western, but I got a degree in 3 years by going to summer school. As a result of that, I could not get a commission for 4 years of ROTC. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what year this was?
What year?
That you got the commission?
Well, I haven't gotten a commission yet, but I couldn't get a commission.
Mm-hmm.
You should. In those days, you could get a commission by taking 4 years of ROTC in some university. I finished in 3 years college, so therefore got my degree in 1926.
26.
And but I couldn't get the commission through ROTC. So to do so, I had to join what we known then as the CMTC, the Citizens Military Training Camp, which was held in summers at various military installations over the country. And you went in as a private on a, what you call a basic course for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
You received no pay for that in those days, but you did get your uniform and bed and board, you might say, while you're in the post. And you had to go 30 days for that. And you went to that for a full month for 4 years, you could get a commission.
Mm-hmm. That's rather rigorous,
yes,
considering you had had so much previous military training.
Well, but when they found out I was a college graduate, even though I was quite young, and had 3 years ROTC, I hadn't been in Fort Knox more than about a week till they made me a platoon sergeant. And I was a platoon sergeant until the end of the 30 days, which meant that you had two sergeants in each company. They were all infantry companies. And two sergeants, one slept upstairs and one slept downstairs in the barracks because they needed somebody with these younger boys to keep peace.
Mm-hmm.
Lights were out completely in the barracks at 9 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm. Well, were these mostly Western Kentucky boys in the barracks, or
no,
did they come from all over?
The unit I was in had them all over. We had some Kentucky boys, but they're mostly West Virginia and Ohio, Southern Ohio boys.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were right rambunctious. So the sergeants were stayed in the barracks from the time the officers left for about 4:35 in the afternoon until they came back 7 o'clock the next morning. They were responsible for all the keeping them quiet and
mm-hmm.
not destroying anything and so on. And believe me, they had some experience that way. Because the first few nights they were very rowdy. I mean, when the lights went out, that's when they started making noise.
Mm-hmm. Were they testing you?
Probably. And particularly on weekend nights, some of the boys out there got a whole little moonshine because we had prohibition those days.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty available?
Well, I couldn't say how much, but I'm sure it was available. They found it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And but the only advantage you had was you had no authority other than that of a sergeant. But the first sergeant had some power because he could put men on KP.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could, as a soon sergeant, you could recommend somebody going on KP and get it done, probably. I remember one Saturday night, when the lights went out, I was always on the bugle played taps, turned the lights out. There was several. I slept upstairs in the barracks because I chose that place. Because a bed right at the head of the stairs. Anybody coming up at night, I'd know who somebody's coming up. And I knew already by checking the beds who was out. I remember one night, the first week, I offered to whip a fellow bigger than I was, and he could have beaten me up. He tried, but I think he was a little bit inebriated when he started up the steps. and I told him to shut up and be quiet, and he said, "I'll do as the damn please." So I knew he was bigger than I was, so as minute as he put his foot on that top step, I hit him. And down the steps he went. And I never had more trouble that part. But during the second week, one night the barracks got so rowdy that we couldn't keep them quiet, and they were throwing shoes clear across the barracks. So mm-hmm. if one hit somebody in the head, probably cut him or hurt him. So I got a hold of the other sergeant who was downstairs, and I said, "I got dressed first," and went down and got him dressed, and I said, "Let's blow our whistles and take him for a march." I didn't know whether we had any legal rights to that or not, but we. Anyway, we got out in the country street, blew the whistles, gave the fall out. I told them to fall out with their belts, and rifles, and shoes, but did not put on uniforms, just come as they were. Some of them were in shorts, some of them were in pajamas. Anyway, they came down and lined up. I said, "Boys, we was after taps and barracks supposed to be quiet and lights are out. You're supposed to sleep. But obviously you all didn't want to sleep. You wanted to have fun. So we're going to do a little military. We're going to march." So we marched them across away from the barracks, out into the fields and so on, where we had a lot of briars and so on, and we marched them about an hour and a half, So they all got hot and tired, and then we marched them back.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got out about 3 hours. Line them up to come to the streets, had an inspection, and some of them were an awful mess. Their legs were cut with briars, and it was bleeding. Which sounds cruel, but I've often thought about it. I felt sorry for those Marines. You may have read in the papers a number of years ago when the Marine sergeant down in North Carolina there, basic training, marched a bunch of guys out and headed across the creek. And lost one or two boys, and the creek was swollen or rain or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I can understand his problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we got all lined up in front of the barracks, and I said, well, now boys, I want you to know that if this occurs again, we're going to have another march. Every night you're all not quiet, do what you're told to do and go to sleep, we're going on a march. I'm sure there's some growling and fussing about it, but not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And would you believe it, that from each week they had an inspection, I mean, they had officers inspection places and got word from some of the regulars. From that time on, each week they had some company got a pennant or something for being the quietest and
but
kept the barracks better.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the best company for that week.
Mm-hmm.
We got it every week in my company until the end of the month. They were a good bunch of kids.
Mm-hmm. Was the fact that you were a college graduate one of the reasons, perhaps, that they tested you pretty severely?
Yeah, I think so, because most of them were, some of them were older than high school people, but they probably hadn't gone to high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have any. I don't think we had but one or two other college students.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Incidentally, your hometown in Western Kentucky was the town of what?
Providence.
Providence, okay.
I was born in Lisbon, but that's because it's kind of a wide place in the road.
Mm-hmm.
They had a church and a schoolhouse and about a couple of dozen houses, I think, and a country store.
Mm-hmm.
But
did you grow up on a farm?
No. My father was elected, he was a teacher. My mother had been a teacher when they married. And he was elected county school superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
In those days you had to run for it in a popular election. And he was elected when I was very small, and he served two terms. And like the old days when it was traditional for the president not to serve more than two terms, well, none of the officials in that county served more mm-hmm. than two terms. Normally, they just didn't run, the people wouldn't vote for him. So my father was county school superintendent, had two terms, and then it's about that time they changed the law and made him elected by a county school board.
Mm-hmm.
But he decided he'd go on another business, he wouldn't make much money anyway.
But you were introduced to politics on the local level very early. Well, I suspect some of that stuck with you.
When I was 5 years old, I used to hand out cards when my father was running to people coming to vote and people over town and so on.
But that's the county there for Providence is what?
Webster County.
Webster County, okay.
The county seat of Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived in Dixon, my father's kind of school superintendent.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to Providence during the winter of 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to the military thing, the Army changes its mind quite frequently, it changes the regulations. Every year up to that year, in 1926, all Blue Course graduates was the last year, summer. all the Blue Corps graduates had been automatically sworn in as second lieutenants if they had, their duty had been satisfactory for those 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the middle of our term at Fort Knox, the Army changed its regulation. So instead of making all Blue Corps graduates second lieutenants to finish the completion of the course, they decided that they should spend at least a year in the enlisted reserves, or join the regular army, or get in the National Guard, and complete 1 year in one of those sources, and then take an examination to get to be a second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
So that caught me, and I joined the enlisted reserves as a private.
This is the year of?
27. And so then I was serving in the enlisted reserves, and we had no National Guard unit in Webster County. So I was serving in the enlisted reserves, and I had to go to camp with them the following year, the summer of 28. In the meantime, I was first a private, and then whoever's the authority, and decided that after all, if I was a private as a college graduate and had completed 3 years in the ROTC,
mm-hmm.
then I should be higher than a private, so they moved me up quite rapidly from a private to a corporal to a sergeant to first sergeant. So by the time it came to my time to go to on active duty with some army outfits, regular army, the following year in the summer of 28, I was ordered to active duty as a first sergeant up to Fort Thomas. Fort Thomas was then, of course, a permanent post right on the river up the side of Cincinnati, south of Cincinnati. And that was quite an experience because I was signed to a regular army company, the only enlisted man in the reserves that in the company, all the rest were the regular army. The first sergeant who had a comparable job to what I was supposed to be training on was getting ready to retire at the age of 60. The youngest buck sergeant, or platoon sergeant, whatever you want to call him, was 45. And I was, at that time, not quite 20. So I was sort of a curiosity, you know. These old regular army men sitting around barracks, and here I'd walk through, they'd kind of jerk around, heads around one of them and say, is that the first sergeant? But it was, that was a good experience,
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot being an enlisted man on duty with a regular army company. But at the end of that time, I was eligible then to take an examination for a board of regular army officers.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I passed it and I became a second lieutenant. Well, there's one other. I was right lucky at that, because in those days you had to be a 21 years of age to be a second lieutenant. But when I filled out my papers for the enlisted reserves, the sergeant who filled out my papers asked me how old I was, and I told him the truth. He said, well, you can't be that young, because you've got to be older. So he moved my age up. I kept the same birthday, fortunately, but he moved my age up. So I was...
By 1 year?
Well, a little more than that, really. So I could... No, when I'm talking about way back there when I was... first joined the...
Mm-hmm.
ROTC over there, that's
mm-hmm.
my, he said you got to be 18. So we moved my age up to 18.
I see.
I was 15 at the time I had my first military training. So I was eligible, so I became a second lieutenant illegally, I guess, because my birthday was the same, but my birth date, year date, was not the same.
Right.
And then I, of course, then in the meantime, I'd been teaching as principal of the County Consolidated High School down Wheatcroft, Kentucky, in Webster County. And
what were you teaching? And what had you majored in college?
Well, I majored in history and political science.
Okay.
Most all department, college departments in those days were combined, history and political science. And I majored in that, and I got a job. County school superintendent, who was a fellow that succeeded my father. Of course, I've known him a long time. And they had just gone into this consolidated thing that has some good points to, but also has some weaknesses. And Webster County, which is not a large county, but we had six county consolidated schools that were going, working toward being a high school.
Mm-hmm.
We had several independent high schools, but the county school superintendent offered me the job as principal of a newly started county high school, which they'd started with a 3 years before with a having a freshman class, and then the next year a sophomore, next year a junior, and they were going to graduate the first senior class the year he wanted me to take the job. And I think later, I think the reason he wanted me to take the job is because, well, I knew that he had to have a college graduate as a principal in order to get his credit. And of course, the high school home wouldn't have been worth anything to the graduates if it was not a graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
there were many teachers who were not
many
college graduates.
Well,
right?
I was the only one in the school, the only one in that particular school.
With a full degree.
Yeah. We had all 12 grades, and one teacher in each grade, and we had three high school teachers and myself. I taught two classes and myself. But, and they had, it was kind of a tough mining town, typical mining town in West Kentucky. Most everything was owned by a company store, or the company which had the big store and so on. Some of my patrons in school had their own houses, but most of everything was owned by the company, practically. And unfortunately, it had a reputation been miners, running some principals out. Principals hadn't lasted very long. I kind of finally decided that one reason they gave me, that offered me the job was that he had to have somebody with a degree. And anybody with a degree with any experience wouldn't have taken the job. But I took it. Had enjoyed it, and wound up with a lot of good friends, some of the best friends in the world, down there in that little town.
Was the animosity toward the principal, the high school principals in that area, largely from the miners individually, or was it from the local miners' union, or can you make any kind of differentiation there?
No, it's just that there are a lot of miners who are kind of rough individuals.
As individuals.
It's kind of like a western town where back in the 1890s or something. Nearly every Saturday night somebody got shot. It wasn't place where they murdered a lot of people, so somebody got filled in the gun and shot somebody. Mm. And they also, when the parent would get mad when one of his children were punished, when he didn't think they should be, or they punished you too severely, and that caused him to run the fellow out of town.
I could. You did not get run out of town.
No, I did not. That fits into my military career, though.
Okay.
And we had a contest in those days with all the county schools. There was about some 60 or 70 one-room and two-room schools, and then the six county high schools, who were either 2 years or 4 years. And I noticed in at the school, school fair they'd have in the fall, or maybe it's the spring, but they had a prize for the school, what they call the best drill school. Well, to me that meant military drill. So I got some boys, good sized boys, and I drilled them in about face and various army movements of a small unit. So they're pretty good. So we put that on, I remember, over to the county seat here in the school fair, and we won a prize on that. But where my real military training came in pretty good, because the schoolhouse was on a little hill, and I lived up there by the school, got board in the room there. And when I was at home one afternoon after school, back over to the field on the bottom land where the mortar backed up in the river in high water, down below the schoolhouse, and I heard some firing and shooting that old woman. I thought, well, somebody's over a target shooting, so I got my army pistol and went down there, and they said, "Professor, come here, we're shooting bottles on top of post on the fence." And I thought that was good fun, but I found that despite the fact that it was a rough town, a lot of them carried guns, most of them weren't too good shots. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been to CMTC and already a year in which I was a lieutenant and I was attached to a regular army outfit. I had made, fortunately, an expert with a pistol, a rifle, and a machine gun. And so I went over and I didn't have any trouble knocking the bottles off. They decided I'd lodgeable with a gun and could hit. About the first week, too, another thing occurred on the ground. You know, every school nearly has a bully.
Mm-hmm.
Some big boy who takes beats on little boys. And I came around and schoolhouse one day at recess, and I heard a lot of noise out there. I went around the corner of the school building, and the school bully had two little boys with a nape of the neck putting their heads together. There was about 40 or 50 kids all around them, some of them cheering them on, some of them horrified and so whatnot. Well, he had his back turned to me, and I sort of forgot. This happened the second week I was there, and I was only out of Fort Knox for 2 weeks. I forgot that I was the principal. I grabbed him by the neck, nap of the neck, and kicked him. And I mean kicked him hard. Sent him spinning. And I think I heard later I sort of cussed him out too. And when I realized I was principal, I looked around and all these little kids' eyes were about to pop out. They'd never seen a principal do that.
Mm. It sounds like the kids largely and the parents largely controlled the school rather than vice versa.
Well, anyway, the word got out over time. They had a new principal who could cuss and shoot. And what else, watch out for him.
And who kicked butts.
Yeah. So I didn't have any trouble at all. So my landlady, their soul, was quite worried because later on when I had one rule, my county board, we had one board member in that district who's part of the county board. The first time I met him, he had ran a grocery, and then put a grocery down, and, no, a dry goods store downtown there. And he was a board member, elected to the people. His first time I met him, he says, Professor, do you believe in licking? And I'd gone to a teacher's college, but they hadn't told me anything about that. I'd required 24 hours in education, but
that was never discussed.
That was never discussed. So I guess I gave him a pretty good answer. I said, Mr. Wallace, I believe in following the wishes of the board. He said, well, we want them licked. Well, I said, in that case, you'll get them licked. So I got together with the faculty, and we made down a list of things, that punishments. Sometimes it'd be stay after school, but that wasn't very good if they lived in the country, because they had to ride back. They didn't have school buses in those days. They had wagons. Two-team wagons, and came four-team wagons when they, you know, winter when the mud and the snow, but wagons with benches along the side of the wagon and tarpaulin over the top, kind of like the ones that our ancestors went to California. And so anyway, we had these rules and certain things, among which was if you came to school, I figured if they came to school in the morning, it's my job to see to stay there for the full day the parents expect them to. So if they left school without permission, any part of the day and missed classes, that was the punishment, was a licking.
And you administered it?
Well, most of them. But we teachers agreed on that, and we adopted them and so on. We told all the students, got a list of them.
And the school board approved.
And one of the things I hadn't said to you, though, that one of the things they wanted to do, they had an outdoor court, which was bad because they income of weather, rain or snow or something, because they couldn't practice, but they did play with some of the schools, had in the past, some other schools, either eighth grade teams or first year high school teams, something like that. But they were all, now that they were going to 4-year high school, they got them accredited. They wanted to have a basketball team, both girls and boys. And I was the only male teacher. And the board wanted me to, in addition to my other duties, to ask if I'd coach basketball. And I said, well, I know a little something about it. Please help me anyway to get started. So I was a basketball coach, but it had a good, one good effect on it. I had all the largest boys in school on corner out for basketball. So that helped me keep discipline. My basketball players would do what you say because they want to make the team. And so all the larger boys were on my side. I remember one day I came home from school, and that day, or the day before rather, three girls and three boys left school, all of them up in the upper classes, long about recess time, and didn't come back. So I knew who they were the next morning. All three of them were told they were going to be punished by whipping. Now, I never whipped any of the girls. I had a very good teacher who I judged. I thought she was an old lady, but I could judge she was probably 40. Big buxom widow. She paddled the girls. I paddled boys. And one of the boys that had done this was my sonner on the basketball team, who was taller and heavier than I was. He was 6'3", I was only 6'1". And he was up for punishment. So rather than have an argument about the matter, I called him in and office, and I said, "Benny, you've broken all the rules, and which you knew that you broke it. Sometime we found out about it, you're going to be punished with a whipping." He said, "Mr. Lloyd, you're not going to whip me, are you?" And I said, "Well, let's talk about it a little." I said, "You're too big for me to whip. You shouldn't have to do that. I shouldn't have to do that. But it's the rule, and neither can I let you off without a whipping and have others whipped. So I have to have a choice of either whipping you or expelling you." And I said, "If I expel you, the board will back me up. But now you're my best player, and you're the only boy tall enough to be a center. And I just don't know what my team's going to do if I have to expel you. So I want you to make a choice whether you want to be expelled or whether you want to whip it." He said, "Can I think about it till recess time?" I said, "Yeah." So after recess, he came in and said, "I'm ready to take my licking."
Mm. What'd you whip him with?
Paddle.
A paddle?
Wooden paddle. Hickory. Hard wooden paddle. Which I'd whittle out myself.
Mm-hmm.
And my office was right off the study hall, and all the kids heard him being paddled, and they came out all red-faced and flustered. And so that helped a little.
Mm-hmm.
In disciplinary matters, I'd say it helped a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in the case of one of the girls, who was also on a basketball team, one of the best players, when my landlady heard that a girl had been punished, she was practically wringing her hands when I came in. She said, "Oh, Mr. Lloyd," said, "you whipped Mr. So-and-so's daughter today." And I said, "No, Ms. Irving, I didn't whip her. I had her whip. I'm responsible for it, but I did not whip her." He said, "Well, did you know that he's always, every time one of his kids got a licking, he came up and whipped the professor?" I said, "No, I wasn't aware of that." He said, "He'll be up here tomorrow." I said, "I'm just so worried about you." Well, I said, "I can't help it. That rule's the rule, and I wasn't going to break it for anybody." So the next day, I kind of expected him up there, but for some reason, he never came. And I found out later, I always let two of my larger boys to get any mail at school for the teachers, or we had to send somebody down to the post office.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have the mail delivered in town. And I always let two boys go down who'd been, said Portman had been good. So turned out two of my basketball players went down there, and the post office was the next door to the barbershop. And they, as boys will do, always a bunch of men sitting around the barbershop telling tales. So this old fellow's in there getting drunk. Oh, look it up, talking about how he's getting ready to go up to the schoolhouse and whip the professor. He's going to cut him down to his size with him. A great big long knife.
Mm. Did a lot of the students also carry weapons?
Not much, no.
But some did?
We didn't permit that.
Mm. But before you became principal, was that
common? Well, they may have. I don't know. Students are more apt to carry knives or brass knuckles.
Mm.
Which are dangerous weapon if you hit somebody with.
I mean, we think of that today as rather common in many inner city schools, but we don't often think about it in a country school situation in the 1920s in Western Kentucky. I think that's a fascinating point.
Well, this really was not in a good agriculture, I mean, where you had what you might call an agriculture community.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all these people lived in a town of miners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you find in those days it wouldn't have been unusual.
Mm-hmm.
In a mining town. But now my boys, instead of bringing the mail back immediately, when they heard that I was going to be whipped, cut up, instead of coming and telling me about it, they ran to tell their parents. And one funny thing about that town was that most good many people had phones, but they didn't need phones. anything of interest would, by word of mouth, it run from one end of town to another in very few minutes. So they went home and their parents mined their clothes that day, and their parents, individual parents, were bully, strong, heavy-set miner. When they found about out that the principal was going to be whipped, they started up the town to barbershop to stop this fellow. Before they got there, word got to him they were looking for him. And he got on his mule and rode back home.
So you didn't have to face the fellow with the knife.
I didn't see him for about 3 or 4 weeks. And when I saw him downtown one Saturday afternoon, and he's all across the street, and I thought, well, I might as well face this right now. So it's a muddy street, but I crossed the street. We didn't have anything with him. And held my hand out. You know, it's kind of hard to hit a fellow when you hold your hand out and shake hands with him. I had my hand out and I called him a name and shook hands with him. I said, I'm glad to see you in town. I want to talk to you about your children. Well, that kind of flustered him. In the meantime, he's when he's across the street over there, he's been talking to another fellow, and he was whittling. A lot of people stood around and whittling. Had a great long, sharp knife whittling. So I didn't see that fellow right on him. But I thought, well, that makes it dangerous. So I picked up a piece of wood on the ground and pulled out my knife, and I started whittling. We whittled with each other and chatted about the weather and crops and so on. He finally, while we were still whittling, though, he finally said, Professor, I was awful mad at you here a while back. And I said, well, I heard you were. He said, I just almost did a foolish thing. I said, well, I heard that too. But he said, think it over. And I decided that if you thought one of my kids needed a licking, and you'd give it to him, and if you give it to him in the future, you let me know and I'll give him another one to get home. So I thanked him. He was as good a friend as I had that day on. Now, whether or not that was part of my military training, I can't say.
Well, it's an interesting relationship there. It seems to have a bearing.
But I was taught to have an enemy, you ought to face him. But nevertheless, I only stayed there 2 years. I liked the place. We did well. A small salary for those days, but pretty good as teacher salaries go. As principal of school, for 9 months, I got $125 a month. Most of the teachers, depending on the experience, got anywhere from minimum was 60, as I recall, for a right new teacher. But most of them drew 70, 75. I don't think any of them drew over 80. Not over 85, I'm sure. So the second year, apparently we won the county, we organized the county basketball association among just the county schools. Not the independent schools, we'd won both boys and girls basketball, so that helped. So they raised my salary up to $175.
Now you won for your league?
Yeah.
Right.
Championship.
But not for the Western District?
Oh, within that county.
Just within that county?
Yeah, within that county, because that's our association.
Now, how did you get back into the military?
Well, that summer I went to active duty camp.
And then
I decided to go to Vanderbilt. I was going to work on a master's. I really intended to take law, but I wanted a master's degree before I took law. Because I think a lawyer needs a very good background in history and political science. So I decided to go to Vanderbilt for law school, and they re-elected me again, but I resigned. In the meantime, I was also elected to be principal over in my hometown, Providence, which was a much larger school, but I didn't take that either. So I went to school at Vanderbilt, which transferred me into a Tennessee Reserve Regiment, and I
But this is now the Depression period, right? You're in the Depression period while you were going to Vanderbilt.
Yeah. So I went to military camp each year out of Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go to Tennessee, but we went to Fort Moultrie one time, Fort Scrivens another time, so on. So I kept the military on up to the time. I used to do just enough of this correspondence work, which the military had in the way of training. Not enough to be promoted, but enough to be eligible to go to camp. You had to be eligible to go to camp. And I figured if I was going to graduate school, I couldn't afford to spend too much time on correspondence work with the military. So I never did. And moving about from one place to another, too, you lose something in knowing the officer, older officers, and that sort of thing.
True.
Anyway, I didn't get promoted at all, so even after I left Vanderbilt and took a job up at Morehead, what is now Morehead University.
Mm-hmm. Now, the years you were at Vanderbilt were?
Well, I was there from 28, fall of 28 till 31.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to Morehead.
And I went to Morehead.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd gotten there in order to, you know, the Depression hit in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd gotten a job up at, as soon as I was schools at West Point, Kentucky, just out of Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
But the years I was, and was going to get a master's.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the Depression started, so that's why I had to get a job up there. But my major professor was a very, you may have heard of him yourself, Frank Owsley, who was a great writer in Southern history and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. One of the Southern agrarians.
One of the Southern agrarians.
Very well known. Yeah. One of the 12.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
the Vanderbilt School of Thought, as they were
saying. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know.
Mm-hmm. So he was your major professor, and you studied your MA under him.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And later on, I know you went back for your PhD. Yeah. Did you continue under him?
Continue under him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there when they wrote that book, I'll Take My Stand.
Right.
And I knew most of the Guerrillans who participated in that. And I had one of the first editions. It's autographed by most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I knew their chapters they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, sometime before I went away to the army, I mean the war, I loaned that to somebody and I never did get it back. I'd give anything for it, but I never got it back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember who I loaned it to.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Frank Owsley was more than a major fuzzy. He was a real friend. And that, before I'd got my master's, along about May of that year, he called me in his office one day and he said, Lloyd, I've been talking to the dean of the graduate school, who's Dean Walter L. Fleming.
Mm-hmm.
Another
major historian.
Yeah.
Well known, Reconstructionist.
Yes, sir. And, we want you to stay on here at Vanderbilt. You're going to get your degree, all right. We want you to stay on here at Vanderbilt and work on a PhD. And I said, well, Dr. Owsley, I appreciate that, but I really can't afford it. He said, well, son, now wait a minute. You didn't apply for it and didn't say anything about it, but I took the liberty of talking to Dean Fleming. We're going to offer you a fellowship. And work on a PhD. Well, of course, the fellowship meant several different things. There's my boy again. So probably I shouldn't have said that, but I said, well, Dr. Allen, how much does it pay? Well, he says it pays $500. I said, well, what do I do? He said, well, we'll have you teach at least one class here in this park. And that you can still take a full graduate lower. Well, I said, Dr. Alley, I appreciate your thoughtfulness and your kindness, but I still can't take it. And I didn't ask you to give a reference on it, but I've got a job up at West Point, Kentucky. They're paying me for a small school, but they're going to pay me to be superintendent there. It's a small independent district. They're going to pay me $1,800. I have some debts, and I feel like I ought to be paying them off. He said, well, is it mostly money? And I said, yeah. I appreciate the opportunity you're offering. It's mostly money. He said, sit here a few minutes, and I'll go and talk to the dean again. So he came back in about 15 minutes, and we got it all fixed. It's a fellowship, which we offered you the same amount that others have been getting. We're going to make you an assistant instructor. And you teach two classes instead of one. And we're going to pay you $1,400. And you can take a full graduate load. Well, I couldn't turn that down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the reason I got a PhD, I suppose. Instead of a double LB. But,
that was a lot of money in Depression days.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, to go to school.
Mm-hmm. Tuition wasn't too high, even Vanderbilt mm-hmm. those days.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed at the YMCA Graduate School, which is right across
mm-hmm.
West End there from Vanderbilt. And the room didn't cost very much.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, I think you could get most any room from those days from $10 to $20 a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it happened.
Mm. So, and then you you did your dissertation, I presume, under Owsley as well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and can you tell us about?
Well, my master's thesis was, in the period that he was very much interested in, pre-Civil War and so on, and he suggested that I do it in that particular area, and I wanted him to be my major professor.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my master's thesis entitled The Southern Justification of Slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finished that, and I'll tell you a funny story about that, he suggested that I continue in the same general field, but expand I could use part of my master's thesis, certainly a lot of my notes on the dissertation, and that we decided the name for that would be the slavery controversy
mm-hmm.
from the period about 1831 to 61,
mm-hmm.
and which was all familiar area to me, but just a different mm-hmm. viewpoint, slant. So that's what I did. But the funny thing, I had a professor at Vanderbilt, he was sort of an eccentric type fella, much the type that was, he taught political science, but he loved to talk. I only had him in graduate school, but I thought at the time he didn't really wasn't up quite the caliber of Owsley and some of the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He taught, I had a course in constitutional law on it because I was trying to get into much of that kind of background as I could. And at that little seminar, I only had one other student myself in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned from some of the undergraduates that you could get him off on any kind of subject you wanted to. All you have to do is ask a question to him and he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the kind of professor that gave you assignments and he expects you to read them. And you could, you're in the classroom, you could talk about anything, politics, women, anything in the world, just talk. But when it came to examination, he had a tough examination right down the line of all the assignments
mm-hmm.
that you may have missed if you thought you'd get by with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot of philosophy from him. For example, he said one day to us, said, "Now you fellas go out of Annabelle here to teach. I'll tell you something about these girls who go to school. Annabelle had only allowed 50 girls in the freshman class in those days. Said, when you have some of these pretty little blue-eyed blondes, cute as they can be, don't be too hard on them. Let them slide by pretty easy. Don't give them an A or B, but let them get by with a C if you want to. Don't fail them. Because if they finally graduate, they're not going to teach." He said, "Now you take a homely little old skinny girl, homely she'd be tough on her. All her life she's going to be a teacher, and every year, 2 or 3 years, she's going to be coming back to the university wanting a recommendation to some other school to teach. Now those little blue-eyed blondes are going to persuade some man to take care of them the rest of their lives. They'll never come back to university for reputation." I thought that was terrible at the time, but as I thought of it later, it was pretty good philosophy. But what I was ready to tell you, though, he made me as mad as any professor ever made in my whole life. I was doing this, he was my second reader.
Mm-hmm.
Housley wasn't my major professor, therefore he was the first reader. And I wrote a dissertation. I'm not talking about dissertation now. I'll get back to the master's.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing the master's, I wrote a dissertation. So I got interested in the subject, and there's a lot of material and that sort of thing, and I wrote too long. When I turned it into Housley, he read it, made some good suggestions, but passed it without any trouble. He said, "I'll sign it." I turned it into a second reader. Got it back about 2 weeks later, and I got it in early, but maybe 2 months before graduation time. He had whole pages marked across with red,
mm-hmm.
make little snide comments over the margin.
Mm-hmm.
Bull, cut it out.
Mm-hmm.
Or you'd write ridiculous someplace or mm-hmm. something else, you know. And I'd worked hard on that, he said, "First place is too long. And I'm not going to sign it. I'm not going to sign any master thesis over 100 typewritten pages." Now it's about 240 of them double spaced. I worked day and night. As you well know, it's harder mm-hmm. to cut down this
mm-hmm.
pad.
Mm-hmm.
I worked day and night, some nights till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And sort of fall asleep, get up when I could, and start again. Cutting that thing down. I only had about 5 or 6 weeks to put in.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it in there. I was mad when I took it in. And he was sitting there at a rocking chair. He had a rocking chair behind his head. He liked to lean back and rock. He said, "Well, you cut it down, Floyd." I said, "Professor Edison, I've cut this down thing down as much as I'm going to cut it down. I've been sweating blood on it, trying to cut it down to what you want. And I haven't got it down that far, and this is all I'm going to do, and I don't give a damn if I never get a degree in Vanderbilt. You can have it. If you want to sign it, okay. I'm through with it." And you know what that bastard did? He rocked back and just laughed and laughed and laughed.
Mm.
And every time he laughed, the better I got. That was a terrible thing. And finally he said, "Well, Lloyd, I tell you, you got that thing in here earlier than me. It was too long. And I figured you'd just been figuring on loafing the rest of the term. If I signed it, I just wanted to see you sweat a while."
Mm.
Which made it matter.
Yeah, sure. Not a very good reason.
I think if I had a gun, I'd have shot it. But he said, "I'll sign it without even looking at it. You want me to?"
How about that?
I want you to read it. He said, I assigned doctor's degrees, it wasn't any better.
Hmm. How about that?
And so anyway, but he's been dead a long time now, so was out of it. I've thought many times that I really got more variety of things from that man as a professor than anybody else I ever had.
Mm. That's interesting. Related to this, of course, is the issue of the Southern agrarians who were considered, and still I think are considered, that to have been, you know, extremely conservative and anti-industrial, and in that context, anti-progressive.
Yeah.
Yet, your career in state government and in state politics has largely been with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and with Progressive Industrial Change. Later on, you headed the Legislative Research Council, which was considered very progressive at the time it was put through. Apparently, the strong conservatism of the Southern agrarian movement and Owsley and the others that you were close to did not make you totally committed to their philosophy. Is
no,
that correct?
Bear in mind, they were all Democrats, except they were conservative Democrats.
True. But they were much more conservative, and they were, by and large, anti-industrial and anti-change. And yet you were more associated with the group bringing about change in Kentucky, as I understand it from our other tape beats and
maybe
discussions.
But I'm essentially conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a sensitive conservative person.
Mm-hmm.
When I see some need for a change, I'm just as enthusiastic about it as anybody.
Mm-hmm. But you were not, for instance, I gather, anti-industrialization.
No.
One of the strong points of the Southern agrarian movement. I mean, they really do not believe in that.
Yeah. No, I'm not like the agrarian work either.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you on that. But things like you mentioned, the Legislative Research Commission, I was in Franklin long enough for the war to see the need for a type of agency which would not belong to the governor, but would belong to the legislature, who could be completely unbiased and furnish some facts.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get any facts themselves because they had no machinery to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor controlled all the heads of departments, so they were told when they asked a question about some department, what needed to be done, is what the department of the governor wanted to tell them.
Well, we want to explore this in detail at another point, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, that although you were so strongly influenced by the Southern agrarians, you know, the I'll Take My Stand group, that in some ways you were not made a total disciple of that movement, and of these very, you know, and very eminent group. And of course your career has been outside of agriculture, as well as in agriculture, but also outside of agriculture. Well, fascinating. What about now your other involvement with the military through
well,
graduate
school? Each year during the summer, I went to summer field training for 2 weeks at various regular army posts. We had things within our regiment. I belonged to the 124th Infantry Regiment there in Tennessee. And on weekends, we had frequently no pay. They pay people that now, but not then. We had contact camps in which we would go someplace and make a study on, we'd go down to, for instance, Battle of Shiloh.
Mm-hmm.
We spent one whole weekend going over everything, all the movement of each.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
All during the time that I was a Vanderbilt, I kept in contact with the military.
Mm-hmm.
through these weekend contact camps. And then when I moved to Moorhead, teach up there. And that Sunday, you might be interested in that move to Moorhead, because Dr. Payne, who was president of the university, or what then Moorhead State Teachers College, asked me to come up and talk with him about the possibility of a job, which I did. This was while I was still down in Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I was finishing up my residential requirements on a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But with that teaching two classes, plus taking a full graduate load,
mm-hmm.
I found I could not finish writing on that. I could do a lot of research, but
mm-hmm.
I could not finish writing on the dissertation. So Dr. Payne offered me this job up at Moorhead, and I talked to Dr. Owsley about it. And Dr. Owsley, as I told you, was a friend as well as a professor. He gave me, I think, very good advice, because he said, we had decided, in the meantime, I had a new dean of the graduate school down there, Dr. Binkley. Dean Binkley and I have been talking about, we were going to offer you an instructorship here at Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I approached him and told him I'd been offered a job at Moorhead. He said, I'd like to have you stay here, but I think for your own good. Just pull that too, Ron, tight. Your own good, it'd be better for you to take it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's a relatively young school, and Vanderbilt is an old conservative school. You go up there as an instructor, and maybe in 3 or 4 years you'll be an assistant professor, and then maybe about the same time you've been another length of time like that, you'll be an associate professor, and then
mm-hmm.
maybe 10 years, you'd probably be a full professor.
Mm.
By the time that time reaches, if you were here at Vanderbilt, being very conservative, it'd take you 4 or 5 years to become an assistant professor, and maybe another 5 years to become an associate professor, and then 15 years would be a short time, maybe 20 would be a short time to become a full professor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get to be that up in 8 or 10 years or more yet, we could bring you back to Vanderbilt, and we couldn't offer you any less rank than you had, so you become a full professor and gain time.
Mm-hmm.
That sounded fine, but and that might have worked out that way. But as it turned out, I became a instructor first year at Moorhead. The second year, they made an assistant professor, a small, relatively small department. And when I took a leave of absence in the fall of 1933 for one semester to go back, I found with the committee work,
mm-hmm.
18 hours a week class work at Moorhead.
Mm-hmm. You were getting A ready then.
Coach of the baiting team, faculty sponsor for one or two things, I could not write a dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a leave from one semester and went back to Nashville to finish it, and did. So when I came back from that, I was promoted to Moorhead to the chairman of the department, and decided he's an older man and he doesn't want to retire. They promoted me to the head of the department.
That was quick movement.
So I got Owsley was right in his advice, mm-hmm. but it's a short time.
I'm not sure that he thought.
So I stayed on there but still regularly went to camp with the reserve army. And the next thing I did was to take a leave from Moorhead in 1936. At the governor's request to come to start a new department in state government. You always could
come
in.
Yeah, yeah,
please
do. Yeah, sure.
Well, I took a year's leave in 1936 as Governor Chandler's first administration. And it was a period of time when Roosevelt, as you may recall, had a whole bunch of professors he got out of Harvard and Yale and various places.
The Brain Trust.
He called them the Brain Trust. So having been a new governor, thought he ought to do the same thing. And he pulled me in from Moorhead and Jim Martin and John Manning from the University of Kentucky and various people to Frankfort. He wanted me to start the Public Assistance Division, which was our Kentucky's first participation in the various parts of the Social Security Act, which passed the Congress in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't, he wanted me to take over, and the act went into effect in July 1, 1935, as far as Kentucky's concerned. That was Kentucky's act to supplement the Social Security Act. It went in effect July 1, 1936, Social Security Act, 1935. And I couldn't do it because I was teaching summer school, and I didn't think it's fair to drop out of summer school after class was already started. So I came down as soon as summer school closed, about August the 10th or 12th, somewhere in there, and started that off. And of course, that's a different story in the military, but to follow through on the military.
We'll come back to this a little later. I'm making a note to myself, okay?
Oh. You want me to?
Yeah, highlight it. And
well,
then, and then
sure.
We can come back to it.
When I arrived, I found that while I was the Director of Public Assistance, my official title, Happy had already gotten 240 workers, field workers for the old age assistance, plus some in the central office, and case readers and typists and secretaries and that sort of thing. But the way we, it would be amusing today to most people schooled in social work, the fact that the way these were selected, the governor or one of his helpers called up the campaign, his campaign manager in each one of the 120 counties in Kentucky, and said, "We're going to start this old age pension," they called it. And we're going to need at least two field workers in each county. So you get somebody who's on our side and helped out well, and they ought to be educated. And let me know the name and we'll appoint them. So they were appointed before I arrived. I don't know whether I could have done anything about that if I'd have gone down July 1st or not. Well, I don't suppose it mattered much. But the funny thing about it is that we had two workers in Robertson County, the smallest county in the state, and two workers in Jefferson County, which had the highest population, and two workers in Pike County, which had the largest area.
Mm-hmm.
So I started off on that, and the governor was very anxious, possibly because following the August primary, the November elections were coming up pretty well, but he was very anxious that we start paying people in.
Before the elections.
Before the elections. Well, obviously, we couldn't get them paid before the primary, which came usually the first Saturday in August in those days, but we had to have it that month. Oh, we got the people together and gave them some instruction on qualifications for old age assistance, what they had to have proof of and so on, and urged them to get somebody over 65 in their county so that it could be passed sometime in August. The governor wanted to have a big thing and bring at least one two from each county had to be good. Mm-hmm. To present them personally, the first checks in the House.
Public relations.
Public relations in the House chamber at Old Franklin. I don't know whether you were familiar with the House chamber, the way it was at that time or not. A big glass dome over it was still there, with no air conditioning. And the August sun pounding down through that.
Through all that glass.
Glass, so it makes it awfully hot. I don't know how hot it got there, but it got unbearable. And I was worried death was there to these old people. We brought some of them in, and the total amount of money we gave them was $30. That's the most. They had to be eligible to draw less than that, usually. And to get them have a stroke in there, three or four of them have a stroke and die right there on the House chamber, that would be terrible.
Negative public relations.
Well, my workers got some ready. We arranged for the workers to bring whoever that kind of in there, but we couldn't do anything much about the air conditioning. And they're going to have it about, in order to get in and get back, they're going to have it about the early part of the afternoon, the hottest part of the day. We managed to do some things. We got some big tubs, wash tubs. In those days, ice houses sold big blocks of 300 pounds ice. We took a put wash tubs all around the speaker's stand up there and put a 300 pound of ice on each stand upright, and each tub looked like a bunch of statues. Put a big fan, about 36 inch wide fan, right behind them, blow the air out across the ice to the old folks standing over there, sitting down out in front. So nobody died. When we got them.
So your first public act was successful. Yeah. Nobody died.
Nobody died.
That's a good start.
But the over a period of time, there weren't enough. You couldn't get enough trained social workers in any state, I don't think, to have them all trained. We only had about five or six we could find anywhere in Kentucky. We got those in to help train these others. And they were the ones who would supervise the field workers, we call them. And a good precinct worker, quite every social worker, I suppose, professional social worker, would deny this forever, but a good precinct worker isn't a bad social worker. They're used to dealing with people. They're used to dealing with people with all means, people who are in want, need something. They're very compassionate. And if you can just keep them from saying, well, I'm not going to give this to one because he's a Republican, or, or this is me, a Democrat, I don't like it. You can make them do fairly. They weren't bad. And the way we got it changed pretty well over a period of time, I talked to these county chairmen, who've been county chairman for the governor. And if we had one in his county that wasn't doing enough work, or wasn't doing very well, wasn't getting up to pass the final test whether they got a check or not, I'd go to the county chairman and I'd say, look, we got a little problem. You want to be able to carry your county in the next election. And while we don't condone in any way and don't permit our field workers to put somebody on because they're 65 years old, they got to be eligible. But if we get a fellow down here in their county that hustles, he'll get a lot more of them on. And be on Friday where you're not getting embarrassed by somebody suing us or something like that, than somebody that doesn't want to do the work. And that's during the period of depression. And many, many people wanted to do the work at $125 a month. So we were able, quietly, over a period of time, to get tired of the county chairman into getting the kind of people we needed. It helped him out, it helped us out. So it worked pretty good.
That's fascinating.
We had the state divided up in districts with a district supervisor. And they were pretty well trained, good people. We usually poured them out of the investment from among the field workers. And so, I thought I could get, being a political scientist, and I'd always thought political scientists were too theoretical and not practical enough. That's the reason I took the job, because I thought I'd go down there for a year, I'd see a lot of practical politics, I'd come back and be a better teacher. So, at the end of that year, I'd been too theoretical too. I didn't have the thing down to the fine point I thought I'd have it in a year. So, governor asked to stay on another year, and I did. And by that time, I was blocking off appointments up at Moorhead because as chairman of the department on leave,
right.
Nobody couldn't put anybody in my place except just acting. So I, by the end of 2 years, I just resigned and stayed with it.
I see.
And then came along World War II. I was still the second lieutenant, but I'd gone to camp. I was ineligible from the standpoint of age. I should have been younger to be a second lieutenant. And too old to be a second lieutenant. And
you always seem to have slipped through the grid on yeah. these regs. You weren't in sync with them.
And, well, the thing about it, I was in the infantry, and the Army regulations provided that to be a second lieutenant, you had to have a vacancy first as a first lieutenant. There weren't many promotions during the Depression, during that whole period of time. And if you got into an infantry company, you had a captain, first lieutenant, and two second lieutenants. And that was a big, long ladder to climb. So it was back, and you were required to have a certain amount of this correspondence work and things like that. As I told you, I just did enough correspondence work to be eligible to go to camp and not enough to be promoted. But I didn't see any great value in being promoted at that time. So I'm sure when Pearl Harbor came along, I remember the day very well because on Sunday I was down, I was on my honeymoon and we'd gone out in the boat out in the Gulf of Mexico. And I came in that night and at dinner time at the hotel, first I'd heard of anything, we hadn't had a radio on. Heard about the Jeff bombing Pearl Harbor. And so I said to my wife, I said, well, I'm a second lieutenant in reserves, and I don't think I'm eligible to go. And I'm too old. But I think that my duty to go. And well, I think she took a dim view of it. She was very supportive. So my wife was very sportive though, she understood it. She didn't take a damn view of the idea, but I wired the War Department. I had a War Department those days instead of the Defense Department. And requested my overage and grade, and then I was supposed to be waived and I'd be ordered to active duty immediately. So we got in the car the next morning, drove back to Frankfort, and by the time I got there, took those days about a day and a half, 2 days. I had telegraphic orders ordering me active duty. So then I was in the Army. And the Army got, like, they had a lot of mix up in those days. Of all things, I was ordered to right field with the Air Force. I'd been nothing but an infantry officer all my life. A friend of mine, John Manning, you may have known him. A professor at the University of Kentucky, and he was already on active duty because he was the captain of the reserves.
Also in political science.
Yeah. And he called me about, right after I got home and said, I know that all the reservists are going to be ordered up. You're going to be ordered up, and I want to ask for you up here in Washington. So I've talked to my colonel about it, and we'd like to have you. Well, I said, John, I'm sorry, but I'm ordered to right field with the Air Force. He said, what in the hell do you know about the Air Force? I said, nothing. Except it was the Air Corps in those days.
Well, it was the new Army Air Corps, yeah. Really.
So he said, "Well, do you mind your training? You've been an infantry. Do you mind being something else rather than the Air Corps?" And I said, "No, I don't mind because I don't know anything about it." He said, "I'll talk to my boss and see what we can do." So he was in the Adjutant General's office, which was the administrative branch of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So next day, I told him my wife had already gone to the upper Dayton to find us an apartment in Wright Field. So I got a wire next day after I talked to John, and my orders were amended to be ordered to active duty on the same date that the previous orders, but to the Adjutant General's office in Washington instead of the Wright Field.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my wife that night and said, she called me. And I found an apartment. I said, "Get out of it the best way you can."
Mm-hmm. The apartments were hard to find in those days.
Mm-hmm. We're not going to Wright Field.
Mm-hmm.
So she came back and, well, they were hard to find. I called John Manning back and told him, I said, "Now look, you got me into this up there. We've got to have a place to stay."
Mm-hmm.
About 3 days later, his wife Sylvia called us back and said, Sylvia said, "In the daytime, she got me, I still don't work. Frankfurt." He says, "I'm sitting in an apartment house and we rent an apartment on, leased it from a blueprint 2 years ago. It's almost complete and we're going to move into it as soon as it's complete. And they have one apartment left. If you want it, I'm sitting here at the phone. You got to tell me now."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Take it." That's the way we got an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure you're wondering about the second lieutenant. I suppose I was probably part of the Adjutant General's department I reported in, I don't think had any second lieutenant except me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
on the rules of that time, and I believe it was 60 days. After 60 days service as a second lieutenant on a job that called for higher grade, you could be promoted. At the end of that minimum time, I was promoted to first lieutenant. And I think, if my memory serves correctly, about 3 months you could go from first lieutenant to captain.
Mm-hmm.
I was moved up every time.
For the minimal period.
For the minimum period, up to major. When I was a major, they sent me on a mission out in New Guinea, the Southwest Pacific. While I was out there, I was promoted to a lieutenant colonel that I didn't know about for that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I was a month before I knew I was a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I became a lieutenant colonel and I got notified. And they brought me back, and that was in July 1944. And I was here a few months and then they sent me to Europe. And I was a lieutenant colonel. It's awful hard to get promoted from a lieutenant colonel to a colonel.
Mm-hmm.
But I was over there and came back from Germany. I was over there right when the war ended. And they kept me over there in the Army of Occupation until February 1946. And I was just about eligible to be a lieutenant, full colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me if I'd stay overseas for 60 days, or in state service on active duty, for 3 more months, I could be promoted to a full colonel. And I said, "No, thank you. You might change the regulation." I said, "That's enough, that happened to me."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "I'd just rather revert back to lieutenant colonel in reserve, because it'd be much easier to find an assignment as a lieutenant colonel in the reserves than it would a full colonel."
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that way. I came back as lieutenant colonel, was discharged, and went right to the reserves again. And order to be fully eligible, I thought I was told it would be a good thing to do. I went to Command General Staff School out at Leavenworth, Fort Leavenworth. And I was taking Command General Staff School, we had a branch here that's organized in, here in Lexington. Part of my work here, I had here. And we had a whole bunch of lieutenant colonels in the thing. Matter of fact, at least two of them were instructors. And the head of it was a full colonel, and he had, of course, a table organization, just like all Army units do. And they had a vacancy coming up for a colonel, and he recommended one of the instructors, as he should have, of course. And I was about finished, but I had not finished my man's staff school. And lo and behold, who do you think got moved to a lieutenant, from a lieutenant colonel to a colonel? I never had known who was responsible for it, but I was the one promoted. Shocked the commandant terribly.
I can imagine.
But I imagine there was some...
Maybe the governor
put
in a good word for
that. No, the governor didn't know anything about it. The governor didn't know anything about it anyway. But, because I didn't take my state job back when I came back. I was tall because my farm had been neglected. I'd been gone 5 years. And I just didn't want to go back to state work particularly. And somebody who an adjutant general of us, some regular Army adjutant general up there, they bound to have been reviewing all these reservists. And he ran into my papers and said, "What? Lloyd Civil Lieutenant Colonel? Why, we haven't poured him since he's out in New Guinea." So they poured me.
Well, fascinating. Can you tell us more about your going back now, picking up some of these threads, some of your work as adjutant general? And
well,
about,
I wasn't adjutant general then.
In the adjutant general's office.
In the adjutant general's office.
And then also the New Guinea mission.
Well, my first duty was working under John Manning, the head of sort of a requisition and record section. And my first job, I worked with John on the occupational manual of relating private or professional occupations with military occupations so that we could fit in men who say, of course, there's no trouble about doctors and dentists, and that's so they go to the medical department. But on things like
professors of political science.
Well, yes. What do you do with professors?
What do you do with them?
Well, they put me studying what to do with these men. I was in the personnel. That's I guess that's a pretty good assignment. But for example, a jackhammer operator. And he's easily trained to be a machine gun operator. That boy back again, I'm tired. I don't know. You know, he may be working there up here somewhere.
Just having a glass of water.
Oh, good. You have a large number of occupations that are close enough related. Whether you want. Well, this may be a little brick in there. I don't know. We were talking about that, my work in the Adjutant General's office, and the first assignment we had, John Manning and myself did most good part of the work on coming up with taking the civilian manual of occupations and transferring and comparing ones that could be most easily picked to study in specific military skills, and that was published back in early fall in 1942, as I recall, mm-hmm. which simplified the work of the Army a great deal, in their, not only the reception centers, but particularly in the replacement training centers. And our office primarily worked with replacement training centers and reception centers because our job was to get troops ready as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And various, according to the needs, we had requisitions. We received requisitions from every unit in the United States to get men from the replacement training centers, and according to, we call them occupational
mm-hmm.
specialty numbers, but they mostly are spec numbers. So we had a number which described the type of work, or meant the type of work, for each individual military position. We went on from that to, from the getting a great many men from draft boards all over the country that were not trained in anything sometimes. That's about the time they started the Army Specialized Training Program, you may recall, to help fill up some of the universities in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not Kentucky, but took the skills that would be needed. Most of them are taking things that mechanics or
mm-hmm.
or physics or chemistry and things like that. And they'd had a great effect on it because I think that brought a lot of, not only saved some of the universities at that time, but it brought a lot of them back after the war was over to go ahead and finish their college studies that they started during the war. They moved me a little later to a position where we dealt purely with troop movements and movements to troops. We'd get a wire saying it all the time. We'd get wires asking people with certain occupational specialties that were coming out of replacement training centers at the time to fill in units where they lost men
mm-hmm.
overseas or didn't have their full complement of men to begin with. Do you want me to go into that question about the how we got the data for where to send them?
Yeah, fine.
I found we were losing literally millions of dollars of rail time and, of course, diesel oil and every other thing the railroads used for electricity and whatnot. By a unit would be need men for certain occupations in the unit. They'd send in a requisition to our office, and we'd fill it. But in the meantime, the unit may have moved from the East Coast to the West Coast, or vice versa, or some other part of the country. And I know of several instances where they were moved to places and take weeks to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally got permission from the General Marshal, the Chief of Staff, and the higher group there in the Pentagon to send us the troop movements on every unit that moved, every day it moved, and every unit that was going to at least receive notice that they would be moved and where. And that way we checked every requisition, even though we might have had the requisition for a year, but couldn't fill it against the what we had and where they were going to be and shift them properly. We saved a lot of time and money over a period of years. And during that time, that they first sent me overseas to check all the training replacement centers out in the Southwest Pacific area, see whether or not they were getting the kind of troops they wanted and needed,
mm-hmm.
and how much delay and that sort of thing was taking place, and whether anything could be done out there to be speeded up.
Before you get into that, could you give us a ballpark figure of roughly how much money was being saved by this new system? Did you ever figure that out, or
well,
do you have any idea about that?
We figured it out in the first month or so when we tried, and we saved over $1 million in the first month.
Mm, well, I think that's worth recording.
But I might say that that was done with the that means we changed the system over the protest of several chief clerks mm-hmm. who've been in the War Department since back in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some difficulty in doing so because their viewpoint was that the system been used and ought to have been all right, therefore they ought to continue.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't work. A peacetime system doesn't work very well in war. But it necessitated our using only people who had been cleared for top secret material. It put us down in the basement of the Pentagon where we couldn't see any daylight. There were literally weeks when we didn't see any daylight ever.
Mm.
We go to work while it's still dark in the morning, go down the bottom of the Pentagon and leave after the sun's down.
Mm.
And during that 7 days a week, you don't see much daylight.
Mm-hmm. Very few people had access to this new information on troop unit movements and so forth at this level.
No, we only used it on the level that had to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And all our talks with units in overseas positions,
mm-hmm.
even Alaska and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had to talk over a scrambled phone, and sometimes one interesting thing about that adjutant general's office is that everybody in there is an adjutant general, not the adjutant general, but mm-hmm. they are an adjutant general. So these units didn't know the rank of the person they're talking to unless they asked and they told them.
I see.
I remember one night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, we had asked to get the numbers of troops available in every unit in the old United States Army outside of the United States. And we'd got them in, pretty much. So I had fellows to colonels, full colonels, fuss about it. I want to give it, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I only, he'd say, who am I talking to? And I'd say, I'm an adjutant general.
Mm-hmm.
The adjutant general's office.
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, well, I can't give you that. I said, well, I'm sorry. General Marshall wants it at 10 o'clock in the morning, and if I don't get it there, I'll have to tell you the one refused to it. I never had any more talk about it.
Mm. Did you have many discussions directly with General Marshall, either during the war or after?
Oh, not me, no.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But did you have any?
Yeah.
Hmm.
But not me from the standpoint of, because that was done to
mm-hmm.
people who had a higher
mm-hmm.
grade than I did.
Mm-hmm. But at some point, maybe you could include some of your conversations with General Marshall on
well,
the taping that we're doing. I know you're on another topic now, and you were getting into New Guinea.
If I went up with my colonel or somebody, or a brigadier general or somebody, as you know, I was two marshal of us, I was just there to answer questions that
mm-hmm.
they asked me or something. Usually they didn't ask those questions, because
mm-hmm.
the fellow was up there knew the answers too.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Well, anyway, in the Southwest Pacific, first, we lost an engine going from Honolulu to Canton. We thought we were going to ditch there, which wouldn't have been very good because it's on the right over the equator, practically. Very highly shark-infested waters. If we'd lost second engine, we'd have been in the water.
Well, who flew on this plane with you?
Oh, that one? No one from our office. I was the only one.
You're the only one.
That's in German.
Okay. This was a solo mission for you.
Well, the plane we were on was really carrying mostly freight.
I see.
Carrying a lot of machine guns and stuff like that. And they only had about, outside the crew, I think they had mostly this baggage and a lot of mail and stuff like that. I think there were only four other officers by myself.
And what is the date on this mission now?
That was in 44, early 44.
Early 44.
We landed at Hawaii, landed at Canton, which is really a tiny little island out in the mid-Pacific Ocean, where you could refuel. Then we had to go back to Hawaii to have to put in a new engine. And I thought they were going to put in a new engine. I tell you, that's one of the hardest things I did, is have to get back on that same plane that I'd seen burning.
Seeing that engine flame out, huh?
Yeah. Well, the pilot, I happened to be the highest ranking officer on there, though I was the only major. And they put me up there. It was a bucket seat, that thing. Didn't have any reclining seats or anything, just bucket seats. Not many of those. So they put me up next to the cockpit, where the door opened to the cockpit. And when I saw this engine smoking, I called this listed man over and told him to tell him up there. And they died of the bomber, here's the bomber, B-24 converted bomber. They died, and I knew they weren't supposed to be diving. It wasn't a dive bomber. But the dive had snuffed out the flames. So then it just smoked. And then the fell to the prop, and we limped on in the water. Whereas we'd lost another engine, we couldn't have made it. But we were slightly closer to go back to Hawaii than on to Canton. But I thought they surely would put in a new engine, but instead of that, they repaired the one that ran. And we had to go back and go do the same trip all on the same old plane. But I made it. We stopped then. Next stop was Guadalcanal. Next stop that was near Brisbane, Australia.
You went straight to New Guinea from Brisbane.
Well, I was briefed there at General MacArthur's headquarters for several days by the G1. And then I went up to New Guinea and I went, traveled every place. We had a replacement depot. We went also over to not New Zealand, but New Caledonia. And I had to make a report, which when I moved from one place to the other, it had to be sealed into with photographs and so on, sealed into a dispatch case labeled top secret. I did fine on that till I got back to California. The customs people in California, they apparently forgot the border law. All baggage that we landed there, of course, at the main air. It wasn't the military air field at all, civilian field. And the customs Later matters, I opened my briefcase and I said, I'm not going to open it. I was very fortunate they had one old Navy admiral on the customs board. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you can't take it. We have to see what's in it. I said, you're not going to see what's in it. And of course, I was coming directly from New Guinea and I had my, still had my 45 on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I said, they said, we can take it away from you. And I said, you can't take it away from me while I'm alive.
Mm-hmm.
They said, would you mean you'd shoot us? I said, I'd try. And I said, I think I can. And the old admiral said, gentlemen, I think if I were you all, I know the young man has his orders. I mean, he has orders to take this to the Pentagon without opening it. I would advise you to let him do it. And I was in there. So sometimes the Navy cooperates.
So sometimes the Navy saves Army. Okay. What else can you tell us about the Adjutant General's office and your assignments there?
Well, another assignment was I was loaned to G1, which is the personnel branch of the Army, to work with this Army Specialized Training Program to put all these GIs into various universities and on.
Mm-hmm.
They had a bunch of, they commissioned a bunch of deans, mostly with higher rank than I had, deans, college presidents, so on, they had the thing up. And they loaned me to them, mainly because of what knowledge I had of the military
mm-hmm.
set up,
mm-hmm.
which I'd learned in the Adjutant General's office.
Mm-hmm.
And, sometimes I had a terrible time when some of these deans and university professors were really trying to pick out the best people for their own universities.
Mm-hmm.
And they went by test scores and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not what the Army wanted, but they wanted to get sent there. Remember we had a civilian, I won't name him because he was a very prominent professor at one of our best Eastern universities. He'd been a specialist in the War Department for a long time. And the job I had at that was that I was a You got some civilians like this professor on it, and really didn't have any career Army people on it, but their job was to help select civilians for being given direct commissions during the early part of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason the Adjutant General signed me to that, it's kind of like a board, was because I'd had some experience in university teaching.
Mm-hmm. It seemed natural.
And these fellows would get in an argument over things and so on. And unfortunately, it was kind of bad on me because I was way back there when I was I was a captain, and all these other military men on there were at least lieutenant colonels or above, and therefore that threw me to be, by Army tradition, the recorder or secretary of the board, and I was supposed to keep track of where all these applications for direct commissions were being looked at and read over and that sort of thing. And some of them would get somebody they knew who would want to get a police car, they'd hold it and let the others see it and all that kind of thing. I had a terrible time like that.
The buddy system.
Yeah.
Well, there's some very prominent people who got direct commissions that you were associated with. Can you discuss any of that?
Well, not give names, I think. One of them, as I say, was a very famous psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
We had another very famous psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
We had some of the people we were giving commissions to, I mean, tendered them, they couldn't draft them,
mm-hmm.
were, well, you know, remember the president of General Motors and made a lieutenant general. 3-star general, directly in the civilian life. And you probably didn't know some of the lowly captains and majors were that selected.
Yeah. So he went from nothing to 3-star general overnight, huh?
Well, that's the way a lot of it. Well, I knew a lot of some of them myself, and every one of them, I'd been at, let's say, I started ROTC in 1923, and I started the Citizen Military Training Outfit, trying to get to be commissioned in 1926, and I'd been in the reserves from about the time on, and I helped get people commissioned from civilian life while I was a captain, who got majors and lieutenant colonels and with the same background I had. Matter of fact, I got mad one night, my main boss in there, one night we were on, periodically it took, everybody had to serve some on night duty officer. And my boss, who was a full colonel, liked to serve with new officers on the first time, so he kind of be sure he knew what they were going to do all right and that other thing. So I was serving my boss, who was a full colonel. And he's not much to do on night duty, really.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be there in emergency telephone situations and so on. So he got talking to me about my background, and I almost got mad at him. He finally went out and said, Lloyd, with your background experience, I would have commissioned you as a full colonel. And here you are, a captain.
Telling remark?
Well, anyway, Army's funny, I liked it. I came back when you got him. I served also, came back, stayed in the way of extra week or so, and came back to brief the Southwestern Pacific personnel people, D1 in Hawaii and so on. And I knew the D1 there pretty well. And he was then a full colonel, but he made general shortly thereafter. And he wanted to know if I wouldn't come back and serve there. And I got back to him. And I said, I don't know where I'm going to go. I think I'm fairly typical of most Army. You don't ever jump in and try to get some job, and you don't ever turn one down. So when I got back to the States, he in turn asked me if he returned from my next overseas duty to Southwest Pacific. And I expected to go, and then I ran into then, when I served on him, he was Colonel Lovett, Ralph Lovett, and he was then Brigadier General and was Adjutant General for Eisenhower's headquarters in Europe. So I ran into him in the Pentagon one day, and he seemed glad to see me. I was glad to see him, and he said, he asked me whether I'd been overseas, and I told him I'd been to the Pacific and so on. He said, well, said, I'd like to have you over in Europe. And I said, I'm sorry, they've asked for me from the Southwest Pacific. And I suppose I'm going to be ordered back there within the next month, so. He said, well, would you prefer not to go to Europe, or would you prefer going to the Southwest Pacific? And I said, I'll just go where they tell me. I said, I think it's a better war in Europe than it is out in the Southwest Pacific. He said, well, said, you can't do anything about it, but said, I'll go up and talk to George about it. So I said, talking about George Marshall.
Oh.
So he had my orders changed, and I went next time to Europe.
Mm. Before you get into Europe, can you tell us what was the essence of your New Guinea report? You know, basically, what did it say, and how was that report utilized?
Well, it was utilized in studies on the replacement camps, because I made reports on it. That's why it's all top secret.
I mean, they actually used it rather than take a report and shelve it, like often happens.
Yeah, but what I did, I talked to the commanders and unit commanders and so on. Mm-hmm. What kind of men are you getting? Are you, when you ask for fellow trained and a machine gun, are you getting a pistol expert or something else? Or are you, instead of a tank mechanic, are you getting a airplane mechanic or whatnot.
Mm-hmm. And what was the result? What did they say?
Well, we straightened the thing out from the standpoint of the procedures to get them and so on. For most part, they were doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some kinks in the thing. Mm-hmm. There's some, you never have all the units doing the same kind of, doing as well as another. So we straightened out some things and we got a right good one in New Caledonia. But then they, at other places, they weren't getting food or anything. I mean, it just screwed up. I was on one little island, I hadn't had anything except some oatmeal. I mean, cereal brought in there by the Navy for a couple of weeks. Well, those birds are going bad. Of course, I had to take the jungle course before I took that in Hawaii. And that was a good course.
Mm-hmm.
They taught you to live in the jungle. And I really believe you could drop me down in most any jungle in the world if I had a long knife, or maybe a few fins, I could make fish hooks out of.
Mm-hmm.
I could live. The only thing I just liked about that, they taught us that if you watch a monkey in the jungle, you're hungry and you watch a monkey, you can eat anything you can eat. But I didn't like the idea of these monkeys scrambling around these old fallen trees and rotten logs, getting these big, great big grub worms, big fat white grub worms, yellow heads. I didn't care what looked. Fried grasshoppers, not too bad, locusts. But you, my report, and you ask about what it ever used, my report essentially was to see whether the system was working out the way it should, and you had a proper flow through channels of the kind of men that units needed. And for the most part, they're doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I know it was used, since I was retired from the Army and so on, I ran into a fellow out, one year the Retired Officer Association met out in San Antonio, and I ran into a fellow I'd never seen before. And he said, you Lloyd, were you in the Adjutant General's office during the war? And I said, yeah. He said, I used your report. That's the only time I ever heard it been used, but I was amazed because I'd never been in his unit at all.
Did you get any feedback on who read your report?
No, not
when it came back, sealed?
Up in the Pentagon, I don't know. I'm sure it read up the G1 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you know, I was going for it one time because they wouldn't send something to you one to check and see what that is.
Fascinating. I know you want to talk about Europe now, but I might interject. Did you ever talk with Patton?
Yes.
In the Pentagon?
Not in the Pentagon, no, in Europe.
In Europe, okay. Well, maybe you can carry us through the European campaign now.
Patton was what I call a soldier's soldier. I saw Patton come through the Pentagon a time or two, but I didn't know him, never met him until I was over in Europe. And USFET, the headquarters in Europe, and I was an adjutant general's office over there. General Lovett was the adjutant general for General Eisenhower. And they sent me pretty soon after it was over on an inspection trip into Germany. And of course, one of the places I went to, Third Army, which is Patton's Army, and the Ninth Army, and the Seventh Army, but dealt only with the, primarily with the G1. But fortunately, I was in Patton's headquarters the day when he had to call in all his officers for a big meeting in Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. And I heard him make a speech almost exactly like George, what's his name?
George E. Scott?
George Scott
the
made
movie version?
The movie on Patton. Almost exactly. Except a little more customers, maybe. Very practical. Now this at this time, was, when I heard that speech, was after the war officially was over.
Mm-hmm.
And he had all his, not all his officers, but all his unit commanders in this meeting. And of course, I was there with a full colonel, and I was a lieutenant colonel at that time. And we were, as being representatives from the higher headquarters, we invited to this meeting, we did. And he was talking to his unit commanders what they should do, he said. And he made a start off speech just almost exactly like they had the movie. But among the other things he said, now, you've got to keep these men busy. The war is over. I want no fraternization of these German women, or any Germans. But you've got to keep them busy or they get in trouble. It's going to be a cold winter, so the winter is very cold over here. I want you to go out there, you ought to put these men to work out in these woods. And the Germans love the woods. They're the finest people on conservation of timber or anybody ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
They love the woods. I said, go out, put them out there cutting wood. You're going to need a lot of wood to heat this winter. If the Germans object to it, shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
If we want a war, shoot them.
Interesting statement.
Another time I was